Group Meeting, Sunday, 18th December, 1988. The second half of the month of December is, of course, associated primarily with Christmas as a great festival. It is thought that Jesus Christ was born on Christmas Day. That may or may not be so. I don't know for certain which. It is said that he was the son of a carpenter who made coffins for those criminals who were crucified. And it is strange to think that if this was the case, Jesus himself must have assisted his father for some years at least, or at least watched his father make these coffins. But the word carpenter may have another, deeper and spiritual significance. You know how in the Rig Veda, the building of the cosmos, the creation of the cosmos, has been ascribed to various gods according to the one which was actually worshipped by that particular group of Hindus. It may have been Varuna, Indra, Agni, and so on. And there was one god particularly, Vishwakarman. Vishwa means all, Karman means doer, maker. Vishwakarman, who was the architect of the universe. Now, I wonder whether there's any connection between the traditional belief that Jesus was the son of a carpenter, in our ordinary sense of the word carpenter, or whether that may have referred to his being the person who carried on the work of Vishwakarman, the creator of the universe. As you all know, as we all know, Jesus came to renew, to bring about a creative renewal in the Jewish world. He was regarded as the Son of God, as such, by those who really knew him and about him. But the Jewish community wouldn't have that sort of thing at all, because the Jews as a group believed explicitly in the unitary maleness of Yahweh. Now here the Jews actually were wrong, because Yahweh, the Yod He, which is one part of the name, and Vav He, which is the other part of the name, really represents the dual aspect of the Supreme Being. It's the male-female aspect regarded as body-mind, psyche and body. The two together in union make up Yahweh. But this, I think, is the knowledge of just a few people. Carlos Suarez, in his book, The Cipher of Genesis, more or less reveals that fact. I don't know what Professor Sholem, who was probably the greatest authority on such matters, what he thought about it. But considering that he showed very clearly that the translation of the Old Testament is rather faulty, it may be also that this idea of Yahweh being a unitary male being is a faulty idea. The Jews disliked the idea because it meant that if God the Father had a son, there must have been some female somewhere involved in it. We have, of course, in the Catholic tradition, the idea of the Immaculate Conception by the Virgin Mary. Now, Immaculate Conception and virgin birth does take place in the plant kingdom, in some plants. But to imagine that a human being is parthenogenetically conceived and brought into being is, I'm afraid, a little bit too far-fetched. And one need not take any special account of it. Of course, the very sincere Catholic believes in it completely, that it took place through the Holy Ghost. But then, you see, there is the argument against it. If the Holy Ghost conceived through Mary, then he was, that third person of the Trinity, was an adulterer. And so was Mary. And where comes her real virginity and so forth? But I mean, that sounds too terrible for people to bear. They won't have it. And the Jews wouldn't have it. When Caiaphas, the high priest, at the end of the life of Jesus, asked him outright, "Are you the son of the blessed?" The Jews would never refer to Yahweh as Yahweh, the holy name. It's the tetragrammaton, Yod-He-Vav-He, you see. And Jesus answered, "I am." And it was for that which was considered the supreme blasphemy that the Jews crucified him, or rather compelled Pilate, Pontius Pilate, to hand over Jesus to be crucified because of that confession. Now, we can all see clearly that Jesus himself was one of the perfected holy ones. And there's no possibility of gainsaying that. He was the sinless one, the perfected holy one. He declared openly that he and his Father were one. Remember, he didn't say two in one, two united, but he and the Father were one. See, something which in the religions of the world, which is not properly taught because it is not understood, is the simple fact that all religious teaching, all the dogmas and beliefs and so on, actually are accounts of ourselves. All religious teaching is a psychological teaching, not psychological in the ordinary sense of the word psychology and psychological in the medical sense. But they tell you the story of your own psyche. You and I are a psychophysical being as manifested in the world. The creative power of the primordial creative energy produced in the first instance the conceptual creation of man. In Genesis, when you find the first chapter, verses 25 and 6, you find the statement, "And Elohim said," this is how it is translated, "and Elohim is one of the names of God, you see. Elohim said, let us make man in our own image." I personally think that that is a footling translation. I think the real translation should be, "Let us create man in our own living likeness." Meditate on that, brood over that, and you will find some extraordinary, you will discover extraordinary things about yourself. The creative energy does not make things. That is left to the evolutionary process, the making of the cosmos and the making of things and so on. The creation which takes place is not even a mental creation, as I dare say Buddhists and many others would have it. It is creation of a nature which is utterly indescribable, because the context in which this creation takes place is the context of infinity and of eternity. The religions have talked of God as being infinite and being eternal. But that which is infinite and eternal is shapeless and formless, whereas that which is brought into existence is shaped and formed, and it functions in space and time and not in terms of infinity and eternity. So now, it was only the perfected holy ones, those who are the true spiritual teachers of our human race, who realized this holistic consciousness, through which they became aware of what we could legitimately call the truth in relation to us as human beings. What the absolute truth may be, no one has known or can know as long as he has any sort of human constitution or human relationship. This, I believe, mind you, I believe, but I may be wrong, this, I believe, is the culminating point for human beings, the realization of this holistic consciousness, which means not that you, the person, transform your ordinary, finite and temporal consciousness into this infinite and eternal consciousness. Because the separate organism, which is a particular thing, cannot contain the finite, cannot contain the infinite. But the finite and temporal, which is you, the organism, can so live that this infinite, eternal, holistic consciousness can supervene through you as and when you are in that condition of perfect quiet, of perfect peace. You will find, if you study the writings of all the mystics of the world, I haven't studied all the writings, but I happen to have become aware of this in a little way. If you study their writings, you will see that all of them insist upon the complete purity of the organism, that is to say, of the psychophysical organism. The whole purpose of the yogic practice as such is the purification of the organism. Purification meaning not merely cleaning out dirt. That is ordinary. I mean, decent human beings have to do that. But it means quietening the organism to such a degree that the brain stops talking. And when the brain stops talking, all conscious relationship with the finite and temporal is completely transcended. I can't tell you more about it in straightforward English terms, but this, I'm sure, is what actually happens. And so, this consciousness of the primordial creative energy, call it God, call it transcendence, call it Brahman, call it whatever you like, that supervenes. When Jesus said, I and the Father are one, and when he said, believe me, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. And he also said that if my Father had not told me all these things, I could not be teaching you this. All those things mean something like what I have tried to convey to you just now. This consciousness supervenes through the prepared organism, through the purified organism, which means that that person is now the perfected Holy One. You see, in the Old Testament, we have some extraordinary statements, and they all come within the first five books of the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Numbers. See, they all come within that scope. You find it said of Enoch, and the name Enoch means intuition, intuitive perception, teaching, truth, and so forth. That's what the name Enoch means. Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, for God took him. They say of the predecessors of Enoch that they lived so many years and died, but they never said of Enoch that he died. Now, of course, the body Enoch died like any body dies. However much a person may be a perfected Holy One, the body inevitably dies, and it must die. It ought to die, simply because the body is a material manifestation which undergoes continuous change. And that change means that a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending, a birth, a life, and a death must of necessity take place with anything which is manifested materially. So the body must die. All the great teachers, they all died, every one of them. But it is said of Enoch that he was not. That was their way of saying that, for God took him. It was their way of saying what I would put as holistic consciousness supervened through that man because of his purity and perfection. And the same takes place in the case of people like Elijah, Enoch, Elijah, and there are some others too. Possibly also Jeremiah and Isaiah. You know how Isaiah, in his book, points out, this is in chapter 45, verse 7. The message he gives out is, from the Lord God, who inspired him to say these words, to write these words. I create the light and I create the darkness. I create good and I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Now you see, that and a similar passage which occurs in Deuteronomy chapter 30. Yahweh Elohim tells Moses to say unto the Israelites, see, I have set before you good and evil, life and death. Therefore, choose good and life in order that thou and thy seed may live. Now the word live in that context doesn't just mean, that this is how I feel it, doesn't just mean biological living. Any fool can do that. But choose the good and live means live the purely human life, which is the life of the happy creator. That is the meaning of the word human, happy creator. The ultimate meaning. You won't find it anywhere else, I think. This is what I say, and don't believe what I say because I say it. Meditate on it, if you can meditate. That is to say, not just go through a verbal ritual in your mind, sitting quietly in a place and going through a certain verbal ritual, just the brain process. Meditation completely transcends the brain process. The brain stops talking, then meditation begins, not till then. So, what should I say? Yes, say unto the Israelites all these things, you see. Choose good and life, that thou and thy seed may live. Live the purely human life, which is the religious life, the divine life. It means that the organism, the person in the world of affairs and things, lives in such a manner that the divinity from whence he derives actually manifests itself. Now, I said for Genesis 1, 25 and 6, let us create man in our own living likeness. It was meditating on that which made me start off in 1978 and 79 with this statement that that each one of us is transcendence embodied. Transcendence imprisoned in us, but imprisoned especially in terms of our ordinary brain consciousness, which is an analytic, discriminative, separative consciousness. It is not a unifying consciousness. It is not the consciousness which awakens you to the divinity embodied in you, to transcendence actually embodied in you. And remember that transcendence embodied in you, in each and every one of us, is something which is utterly original. It is not the same as in anybody else. This is the extraordinary thing, that transcendence is the unitary, infinite, eternal whole, the holy, the perfected thing, you see. But its creative activity is of such a nature that it produces infinite, it produces countless variety. And each, and the evolutionary process has also given rise to infinite variety. This is the extraordinary thing, that the higher and the lower, if we may misuse two words in the language, the higher being the spiritual, the lower being the manifested, the material, the higher and the lower correspond to each other to an extraordinary degree. Each one of us, talking in terms of the lower, each one of us as a separate being is utterly unique. There never was, there is not, there never will be any other person like each and every one of us. Now, our task is to awaken to that uniqueness within us. We have to wake up to it. And that one may legitimately call the real self of that person. Because when we talk of a person or the self, we are talking in terms of separateness, differences, not a unified whole. The cosmos as such is a unified whole. We are conscious in this ununified manner. We are conscious in terms of separateness and otherness. That is why we are restricted to the finite and the temporal. We are the slaves of space and time. But we can transcend space and time through the purification of the manifested person, personality, in space and time. Now, Jesus gave certain teachings in that connection. He gave the famous Sermon on the Mount, which is the supreme teaching that he gave. What is this mount? Was it a real mountain up which he climbed? A physical mountain? It may have been. In my own lifetime, during the war years, when I was sent around lecturing to the troops, Army, Navy, Air Force, not only British, but also American troops, there were two occasions on which I had to talk to American troops. There were 10,000 of them scattered all over a hillside. And I had to walk up to the top and speak from there. The officer who introduced me to the public, his voice was hardly heard by all those who were very much below. Then I had to speak on Indian culture and history. And believe it or not, I find it hard to believe today, considering my decrepitude. Everyone heard every word of what I said. I had a tremendous voice in those days, and I had a knack of throwing my voice in such a manner that it would go right to the back of any hall or an open space. So Jesus may have gone up a mountain and spoken. But I think there is another way of looking at it, perhaps a deeper way. This idea of the holy mount comes in all the religions of the world. In Hinduism, we have Mount Meru. in Zarathustrianism, we have Ushida Rena, which the Zarathustrians actually locate in the Elbers Mountains, which of course is all absurd. My people, my own community don't like me because I'm such a heretic. I mean, as far as all that is concerned, they like me because I'm a nice fellow, which is all absurd. And here you have the Sermon on the Mount. Now, the Mount Meru, Ushidarena, and the Mount, whenever the Mount is spoken of, it refers, I'm sure, to the Sahasrara Chakra. Those of you who know your yoga well will appreciate that fact, that there are these various chakras starting from the base of the spine to the seventh chakra, which is the Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, as it is called. And it is said that when the yogi has realized the perfection of body and psyche, the purity of it, the complete purity of body and psyche, and the serpent fire, the feminine element, has climbed up the whole of the spinal column, it meets its Lord, Shiva, who resides here. This is the point of contact with the third person of the Hindu Trinity. The third person, because the third person is the creator, is the destroyer, regenerator. I think it's a pity that so many people present Shiva as the destroyer only. That is a mistake. This is the destroyer, regenerator, which is true to facts, even material facts, because nothing in the cosmos can be annihilated. Everything undergoes change. It is only transcendence which is the immutable. But all this, the manifested cosmos, is the mutable. It changes, you see. So now, Jesus going up the mount, to me, means that he entered into that state which transcends all the states of consciousness a purified person can realize for himself, and the holistic consciousness begins to supervene, to function. In fact, the Lord God speaks through him. You will notice that in the religions of the world, people have tended and do to this day worship the teacher, the supreme teacher of their religion, as the incarnation of deity itself. Krishna was God incarnate. Jesus was called the Son of God, and so forth. We had in the Hindu writings the Brahmaputra, the son. Putra is the son of Brahma, the creator God, God the Father. I and the Father are one, said Jesus, and so forth. You see. So now, it was from this state of consciousness that Jesus spoke those words which constitute the Sermon on the Mount. Now, those words are simple words, true enough. But, unfortunately, unless we can enter into the deeps for ourselves, we take them literally. I'll give you one or two examples. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And they shall inherit the earth is taken for empire, which covers the entire globe. Perfectly stupid. But then we are stupid to start with. The meek. What is the meaning of the word meek? In the English language, it's mild, it is gentle, long-suffering. He is the meek fellow. The fellow who isn't strong. Who cannot catch hold of you and throw you over the wall. That's the meek fellow. The Greek word in the texts, in the original texts, is praos. Pi, rho, omicron, alpha, omicron, sigma. P-R-A-O-S. Praos. And the Greek word praos was used in connection by the Greeks with a colt, a fresh colt, who had to be tamed and trained. So the process of taming and training the untrained wild colt, the wild colt, was the word praos was associated with that. And that got translated. And of course, when the colt is tamed, first tamed, and then trained, you see, he becomes quite docile, and he becomes obedient. Let me digress for a moment. The word obedient. To obey in the ordinary meaning of the word, especially when we are young, is to do what we are told. That is to say, some power compels and the compelled one carries out the compulsion. That is obedience. That is not its true meaning. The word obedience comes from ob and audire, the Latin audire, to hear, to listen. So now, obedience means to listen. And the point at issue is this. If you listen in the right way, then you will have insight into exactly how to live, how to carry on with your daily life, and so forth. That is the meaning of obeying and obedience. Now, listen to what? Not to me, not to any other person, not to anything, but your own inner self, your own inmost consciousness, which is in tune with transcendence, actually. You listen to that. How do you listen to that? When you listen in the ordinary way, you will find yourself talking back at the speaker. You're always talking back at the speaker. You can't stop it. You're either agreeing or disagreeing. You say, oh, that's fine, or that's nonsense, etc., etc., etc. When all that sort of chatter stops, you have just to become aware of that chatter, not fight against it, nor be in favor of it if you approve. Neither approve nor disapprove, but just observe quietly. Then this peculiar quietness will steal into your whole being. And when that quietness steals into your whole being, then as the brain listens to the words, you will be listening truly. You will have insight into the inner truth of what is being put before you. It's very, very difficult, believe me. I've tried it 60 years and it's difficult, very difficult. Listen in that way. And if you listen in that way, you will be able to listen to this, what is called the still voice within oneself. The yogis associate that with the Ajna chakra between the eyebrows. That chakra comes to life. And you are able to have true insight into actuality as it is. So now, it's the same with seeing. Seeing, listening, these are very much alike in the spiritual context. So now, we have dealt with being made meek. The Christian mystics have used the word meek and meek as a verb, to be made meek in that sense, to be tamed and trained psychophysically, completely purified. Take again the other, I think that's the last beatitude, isn't it? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Who are the peacemakers? Yasser Arafat and President Reagan? No. Within ourselves, there is this constant conflict, the yes and the no, the good and the evil, the pleasant and the painful, and so forth. The masculine and the feminine. Each woman has her animus, each man has his anima. As and when there is the harmony is realized between the masculine and the feminine in each and every one of us, then the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven is realized. That unity, that marriage is the wholeness of that person. He has really entered into the state which leads him to become the fully holy one ultimately. The masculine and feminine elements have to be unified, you see. Then there is peace, there is quietude. And in that transcendent quietude, you have become the child of God. You have really reached the culminating point of your evolutionary development. The religions all teach we are the children of God. In which sense are we the children of God? Now look, an elephant's child behaves like an elephant, doesn't it? An ass's child behaves like an ass. But many a human child behaves like a silly ass. Isn't that so? If we are the children of God, then we are godlike, necessarily. Or at least we should be godlike. Isn't that so? But this is the way. The religious life is the way to this perfection of our human nature and the fulfillment of it. And then we shall be called, we shall be recognized as the children of God. You know how the centurion at the crucifixion, when the veil of the temple was rent and there was an earthquake and so forth, that centurion said, truly this man was the Son of God. All these things have their meaning. They are deep inner meaning. I have tried in my little way to suggest what might be the deep inner meaning. But each one of you must work it out for yourself. Don't take my words. Don't take my words for truth. They are, after all, only words in the language. When you discover that truth for yourself, you will experience this extraordinary creativeness of the transcendent energy, the transcendent creative energy within your own being, and realize that it is the great creative power which unifies and perfects everything in life. So now Christmas really is a celebration of that sort of thing. At least that's how it seems to me. And it brings not joy which is pleasure, it brings bliss which is infinitely quiet. In that blissful state, you can experience it. I know what I'm talking about here. In that blissful state, you will know the meaning of deathlessness in the real sense of the word. You will at least experience a touch of the supervening of that holistic consciousness. The Buddha said the same sort of thing. You'll find it in the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya when he's talking to Aggivisana. He talks of him entering the Shunyata Phala Samadhi, which is this state of holistic consciousness in which I constantly abide, he said. You can relate that to I am in the Father and the Father is in me, and so on. The terminology is different, but the actuality, the truth, is the one and the same. Thank you.